the end of 2003, you know, when Bush comes out and says mission accomplished, and in early 2004 to November, you all that year, did you feel an energy shift, or was it just always in it and always felt the same to you?
All right. So I was over the border, probably some of the first trip, and we made our way north from there. We never met anyone who wanted to fight. Met a few Iraqis running off in their underwear, you know. Yeah, I'll give you an example, right? We did, my team did the close target reconnaissance of Basra Palace with the NSW, you know, the special boat guys from the States, plotted targets in the palace, had a C-130 Spectre gunship on call, and we could have hit every single one of them.
Hello, and welcome to episode 44 of Let Them Eat Cake. My name is Jack. My co-hosts are John and Ace. Today, we are talking to a private military contractor with experience in Ukraine, the jungles of Africa and South America, and many, many more environments. He gives us a rundown of how life as an operator is, stories from his time in foreign nations, and much more. But before that, let's get into some important headlines for everybody.
Major updates throughout the southward region in Asia. First, Indonesia. Indonesian elections have concluded with Prabowo Subianto claiming victory with 60% of the vote. Subianto is an ex-general who's been banned from the U.S. due to allegations of human rights violations. He served under Suharto, so you can kind of put two and two together there. His reputation as a hot-headed strongman is well known, but his campaign focused on a strategy of making him look like a gentle old man. International neutrality is expected to be maintained, with both American and Chinese investment being welcome. Concerns have been voiced about what could be the new Duterte of the region, or even bring back policy from the era of Suharto, including a higher inclination to use military to defend territorial claims threatened by China in the South China Sea, while also risking involvement with the West Papuan movement, where Indonesia's army has already been deployed. An update in Pakistan's elections. Two of Pakistan's major political parties have come to an agreement, naming former Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif to lead the country in a coalition between the Pakistan People's Party, formerly Bhutto's party, and the Pakistan Muslims League, formerly basically taking Zia-ul-Haq's dictatorship, and they wanted to turn it into a democracy, or a Democratic Party, which is that league. Not to be confused with the Muslim League that founded the country behind an actual good politician. This comes 10 days after tense negotiations to come to a conclusion following a largely inconclusive general election. The candidates of Imran Khan's banned political party, the PTI, were first to run to as independents. They also banned the use of symbols. I've explained this a few times, but in Pakistan, where there's multiple languages and you're not sure of literacy rates, they run on like literal clip art symbols. Like they're the most simple clip art symbols you could ever see. And so they use those symbols to be able to identify the party on the ballot. So they also banned the use of that symbol, which is a pretty big deal to ban the name and the symbol of a party. That party still won, but they didn't win enough to obtain a simple majority. So the two major parties who are political dynasties have basically come together in their coalition to overwrite, even though Imran Khan, the joke is like, how do you win an election from a jail cell? And I just keep telling people it's the same country as America. There's no different. Two dynasties competing, one guy comes in, they have to send him to jail to get him out of there. I'm not a fan of Imran Khan, but one of the charges they have against him is they invalidated his marriage and basically called him a sodomite. You know, it's like, oh, you're not, these kids you have are invalid because we said your marriage is illegal for some reason. You know, they like annulled his marriage so that it was illegal to have sex in the past that he had.
That's insane.
That's one of the three charges they have him on. Isn't that wild?
That is actually crazy. I didn't know that.
That said, this is completely normal for Pakistan. A lot of, actually, in that region, in that hemisphere, it's not abnormal that the outgoing government goes to like some sort of detainment. Myanmar, for example, somebody was in detainment. Thailand's prime minister, they just let out, who was detained before. They just let him out a few days ago. So it's fairly common in the region. Sikh farmers have begun protesting.
Say the line. Say jumping the border to India. Come on.
Okay,
I put it there for a reason.
Okay, a hop, skip, step over the border. Jumping the border to India. Sikh farmers have once again started protesting in a continued effort to force the prime minister's government to guarantee securities for crops, either a minimum guarantee or state support ingrained in law. The Indian government already subsidizes the farmers in a tune of $24.7 billion to ensure 800 million Indians are getting free rice and wheat. These protests began after Modi's government removed the farm laws that were put in place in 2021. As I said, these were basically a continuation of these protests. On February 19th, Modi's government proposed a 5-year minimum support price for pulses, corn, and cotton, but fell short when the Indian Farmers Union rejected the deal. The union discussions came following a weeks-long protest demanding higher guaranteed prices for up to near 24 different crops, which saw the Indian state drop tear gas on protesters from drones. Some analysts have claimed that the government has completely sidestepped any and all demands put forward by the farmers, saying that they should address at a minimum the minimum supported prices for crops. In Africa, ongoing protests in the West African nation of Senegal over President Macky Sall's decision to delay elections. Elections were supposed to be held on February 25th. The delay is said to be the nation's worst crisis in decades. However, the Constitutional Council intervened on February 15th, resulting in a permitted protest on Saturday, February 17th, and a guarantee of holding elections, but no date has been set. The police were still present at the protest, as they were at previous protests, but this time with a big difference. There was no riot gear and no violence, which riddled the initial protests following the decision. For now, only time will tell how the Senegalese will deal with this democratic crisis within their nation. I believe there has been updates on this, by the way. So according to the council, he cannot stay in power beyond April 2nd.
That's the day they set.
And it says 15 of the 20 candidates were approved. They have Iran does this too, where they approve the candidates who can run. it may not be democratic, but honestly, it is a pretty good policy for a lot of these countries, you know?
Yeah. Unless you get people deciding that aren't the best people to be deciding.
Obviously, yeah. No, that's the thing. It's just like when it's like a colonial power being run by France, you know? They want to make sure they keep those capitalists in power. So they're going to be like, you can't run. And finally, Haiti. The small Caribbean nation is on the brink of civil war, according to the Dominican Republic. So if you're bad at geography, they share the same island. Stating that in event of conflict kicking off, the Dominican Republic will have no choice but to protect its own self-interest if the international community doesn't intervene. As we previously reported, the United Nations Security Council has approved a Kenyan-led multinational security support mission to enter Haiti and restore stability. However, the entire operation has been delayed time after time because of challenges in Nairobi, logistical issues, or funding. We've gone over this in the past as well about what the specific challenges in government have been, primarily being that this should be a military operation and they're sending regular police, resulting in further destabilization of the nation, further spiraling into a state of potential civil conflict. Haiti hasn't had elections since 2016, and their president was assassinated in 2021, which the Dominican Republic says was the beginning of this spiral down and triggering the current crisis. Definitely one to watch.
Okay, leaving democracy, we're moving to Oklahoma. We are talking about the tragedy that is the story of Nex Benedict, a 16-year-old non-binary student who was viciously beaten on February 7th of this year in a bathroom at Owassa High School in Tulsa County, Oklahoma. The following day, Benedict succumbed to their injuries and died, according to the relatives and friends. They went on to say that Benedict was a happily outspoken person and expressed sadness when one of their teachers was removed from their position due to brigades by the owner of Libs of TikTok and notorious anti-trans stochastic terrorist Chaya Raichek, who targeted the teacher because they were an open ally to LGBT students within this specific school. The February 7 incident was reportedly over within 2 minutes, stopped by other students and the teacher that was allegedly supervising outside of the bathroom doors. The altercation involved at least 3 older female students, where at one point, one of the girls was pretty much repeatedly beating their head across the floor, according to the mother of the best friend of Benedict. They then went on to ponder that the death could have been connected to some kind of traumatic brain injury. However, the Owassa Police Department have said that they're unsure whether Benedict's death was connected to the fight or some kind of medical issue. The school allegedly got all students checked by the on-site nurse and assessed, with one, likely Benedict, referred to an off-site medical professional while determining an ambulance was unnecessary. The OPD turned up at the hospital around 3:30 local time on the same day after being called by Benedict's guardian. I believe it was their mother, according to the OPD. They were entirely unaware of the situation in the school, despite the resource officer allegedly also taking a report down themselves, but not relaying this information to the police, resulting in the OPD taking their own independent report from Benedict's parents at the hospital. They were then released and rushed back to hospital the next day, where they were pronounced dead. They were laid to rest on February 15th. It's unclear as of yet whether the attack was spurred on by the American social environment largely fostered by Chaya Raichek that is becoming rapidly conducive to the genocide, or simply an altercation resulting in the death of one of the parties involved. Conflicting reports claim that Benedict was unable to walk under their own power, while others claim all students were mobile and aware. Either way, what has happened here was easily preventable tragedy that didn't need to happen. So now for some context. The state superintendent, Ryan Walters, has been on record in video released by the Oklahoma Board of Education that explicitly states their intention to enact anti-LGBT legislation and guidelines within schools, refusing affirmations and making life as hard as possible for people simply trying to live their lives in peace. This has been signposted by Chaya Raichek, who earlier I labeled as a stochastic terrorist, and this is because she has been running this harassment campaign through her Twitter account, Libs of TikTok. But before I go on, I'm just going to give the definition of the word, because I'm not sure if people truly understand what this word means, and it's very important to get across what she's doing. So the definition is: stochastic terrorism involves the use of mass media to provoke random acts of ideologically motivated violence that are statistically predictable, but individually unpredictable. So just let that sort of stew there a little bit and truly understand what she's doing with this account. So the Owosso High School had previously been a target for Raichek, but not the only one. Often her stochastic attacks result in personal death threats, bomb threats on schools, libraries, and public places, with even lynching threats having come through too. Pretty much all of them tying back to posts made by the account, which she often also deletes because she knows what she's doing. She gets away with it through plausible deniability, despite many of her posts being linked directly to threats of varying severity. Many of these accounts also follow people like Ben Shapiro, the head of the Daily Wire, Matt Walsh, a self-described theocratic fascist who rails on trans people almost daily, Michael Knowles, who said, quote, "For the good of society, transgenderism must be eradicated from public life entirely." An account called End Wokeness that is essentially just a reposter for Libs of TikTok, giving her even further reach, and many more accounts that are constantly pushing for unfounded hostilities towards trans people, and not just trans people, just people in the LGBT community that don't agree with them. Raichek is a real estate agent by trade who decided to start harassing trans people and use this account to do so. It was then spotlighted by people like Tim Pool, as previously mentioned, the Daily Wire, Joe Rogan, Tucker Carlson, and much more, gaining not only millions of followers ready to harass the LGBT community and their allies, but now a place on the Oklahoma State Department of Education's Library Advisory Media Committee, appointed by the state superintendent, Ryan Walters. There's that name again, where she can now personally have a hand in banning books and stopping education. Yeah, and we actually did an interview recently going over some of this and addressing her directly. This also follows the video that I mentioned earlier that was released about 7 months ago, where Mr. Ryan Walters states, and this is a quote, that "we have been clear here that we are going to allow boys into boys' bathrooms and girls into girls' bathrooms, and there's dangerous consequences when common sense is vacated," and other bangers like, "what we've seen is an assault on the truth in our education system, and what we've seen is instead of telling kids that there's two genders, it's biology, we have injected radical gender theory into education, telling kids that they might be other genders. It's dangerous. It puts our girls in jeopardy and endangers their safety." He says this in a video And then, surprisingly, he comes out and makes a statement about Nex and their death, and says, "The safety and security of our students is my top priority, as well as the first responsibility of Oklahoma schools. I mourn the loss of our student in Owasso and pray for God's comfort for the family and the entire Owasso community." So I'm just pointing out here, this guy is not a friend. So he is the one who appointed her to this board. This is the same dude who says safety is a top priority while putting the person who created this environment in a position to wield actual control over their lives in a state she doesn't even live in, nor has children in schools there, nor a field that she has experience in. So the question stands, how many more LGBT kids have to get beaten to death before the issue is addressed? So far, the GOP seems grossly incompetent when it comes to reining in the fascists in their own party, or its willful ignorance allowing it to continue because of politics. Either way, it's revolting, and regular people need to stand where the government is failing these groups.
Before our episode about the private military contract circuit, I just wanted to say that if you subscribed on Patreon, the episode has already been released early for you. And in the future, we're going to be releasing unedited standard cuts to the Patreon early, basically whenever those standard cuts are done. So it might be weeks in advance, but either way, the news is now separated from those episodes, so you can watch the episodes early and then catch just the news.
But we have a little bonus for everybody. We have our Ukrainian correspondent giving us a story about the most recent city to fall to the Russian invasion. Our correspondent is from Ukraine, from the east of Ukraine. He gives a short little rundown of what happened in Avdiivka. So
also, our correspondence team works directly on the ground with people still in Ukraine. Yes. It's a combination of multiple people.
Yeah, this is just one of these parties that we have helping us. And we are very thankful for it. And you guys supporting us helps keep this going.
Subscribe to our Patreon. This will change in the future, but right now it's any money, $1, $10, whatever you want. You'll have access to all features. Mm-hmm. When we stream, your name will be at the bottom of the stream and you'll get access to early episodes along with exclusive content that's already up there right now.
And more coming.
Join now.
Good time of the day, everyone. Allow me to briefly introduce myself. On the interwebs, I go by Alucard. I'm Alucard Hex on Twitter, which we still call it Twitter in this household. I was born and raised in northeastern Ukraine. And today, I'm here to talk to you about the Battle of Avdiivka. For those who don't know, Avdiivka is a suburb of Donetsk, and is thus a town that has been on the front line for almost 10 years. Literally, as I'm recording this on February 19th of 2024, and on the 20th, will be the 10th anniversary of the broader war between Ukraine and Russia. Thus, the town of Avdiivka has seen more war than some countries have seen in their entire history, and it will see plenty more for the foreseeable future. Nevertheless, an important change has occurred recently. For the first time since 2014, Avdiivka fell to Russian forces. Now, how did this happen exactly? A few months ago, after the culmination of the Ukrainian summer offensive, Russia began its winter offensive, with Avdiivka being among its most desired targets. The city's defenses were quite strong after 10 years of resistance, but eventually, after taking colossal casualties, Russia was able to slowly but surely force the Ukrainian forces to retreat. Of course, events like these are hardly simplistic in their nature, and there are multiple reasons for why things went down the way they did. The primary reason, however, that was highlighted both in the media and in my private conversations with soldiers that serve in that direction were shortages of ammunition. Now, this issue itself is also multi-pronged. So, of course, Ukraine's own stocks of ammunition it had at the beginning of the war have long since run out. Really, there are very few countries on Earth that can endure 2 years of nonstop warfare without needing a sort of a top-up. So it has to rely on deliveries of ammunition from its allies in order to continue fighting. And unfortunately, as of late, the allies have been coming up short in terms of delivering the necessary amounts of ammunition. So, for instance, last year, the European Union promised Ukraine to deliver 1,155 millimeter artillery shells by about March 2024. And what happened with that? They are on track to deliver just over half of that amount. So I think about 650,000. Why? Slow contracting, underestimating the complexity of the task, because once again, you know, all of the European militaries are in rough shape. The same with their defense industrial factories and such. And the governments just don't know how to, you know, what a significant task that is to procure such a large amount of ammunition. And they are either, you know, in some cases unwilling, in some cases they just don't know how to think creatively on this front. Meanwhile, in the United States, the problem has a slightly different nature. There, additional aid to Ukraine is being blocked by the Republican Party in the House of Representatives, who have sort of been captured by isolationist moods as of late. Now, the reason I bring up all of this is because you, the viewer, likely have the capacity to influence the situation, even if only by the tiniest bit. If you want to save lives, I guarantee you that some extra ammunition would save lives, both of Ukrainian soldiers and civilians. If you want to save money, then giving Ukraine what it needs to defend itself, and thus shortening the war and making Russia pay for what it has done, will save money. Just imagine what would have happened if all of the aid that Ukraine has gotten over the last 2 years was instead delivered in the first month. You know, we might be done with this whole thing by now. And on the other end, imagine if aid is cut off completely and Russia wins. You know, sure, you might not need to worry about eating Ukraine anymore, but chances are you'll have to worry about the myriad other ways that Russia could escalate this conflict beyond Ukraine's territory. So, the point is, whatever country you're in, call your representatives, tell them to stop messing around, and support Ukraine towards a swift victory. Thank you for your attention.
We have a weapon more powerful than the British Empire, and that weapon is our refusal to bow to any order but our own, any institution but our own.
I grew up on a pretty rural area in the west of Britain. If you're American listeners, I guess, this is very similar geographically to West Virginia, I guess. And the people aren't that much different either. having traveled to both and grew up in one, I was originally going to be a lumberjack, work in a forest, you know. But a lot of the forests were getting sold off, and I was riding home one day, I was about 17, and it was this time of year, snowing like crazy, and I seen a guy running through the snow towards me. It was a mate from school, and he looked twice the size, suntan. I was like, what are you doing, you weirdo, you know? And he said, oh, I'm in the Marines, and I've just come back from the Caribbean. He then proceeded to tell a complete bunch of lies about all they do is sunbathe, go to the gym, and party, and do a little bit of work. So a couple of weeks later, I left, joined up, ended up after 15, 16 years running a surveillance and reconnaissance team in a surveillance and reconnaissance unit. Within 3 Commander Brigade. And then left. I'll go into the reasons why later. And went on what commonly known as the circuit out to Baghdad. And then from there, it led to, you know, globally working, some good, some bad, some amazing. And here I am now. I've just returned from Ukraine. Just before that, I was in Lebanon and a few other places.
Can you say what you were doing in Ukraine? I'm curious.
Probably November 2021, when you could see the buildup of Russian forces around Ukraine. I was following it and its naval groups for the naval exercises they were running in the Black Sea. And they were cancelling them and then moving, and while they did that, they've moved more troops in. And I just knew something was going to happen. It wasn't an exercise at all. They've never done this before. And all the indicators were pointing towards them invading Ukraine. So I thought, rather than wait, I'll go there now. So in January the 4th, over a month before the invasion, I went out. I've got a lot of friends from Ukraine I worked with in Baghdad years ago that were part of their old special forces. And I'd stayed in communication with them. So they were in Ukraine. A couple of them were still in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I linked up with those guys. And what I did basically was, do you know what spot coding is?
Say it again.
Spot coding.
No, basically, I'm not aware of it.
Okay, so it's basically mapping an area with coloured spots from, you know, known points, junctions, main buildings, hospitals.
Okay.
And I did that in a lot of the cities and towns around Ukraine. I also had a look around the strategic areas where they might come in, you know, the Hostomel airport and likely crossing points, and then spoke to a few guys I know out there. And basically, the Dnieper River cuts the country in half almost. And they were preparing the bridges then in January. They knew it was coming, as in prep for demolition. And later on, we've seen that where they did blow the bridges. I then went down to Donbass, where likely areas would be, and then where they'd come in. And then through friends, or not say who, in country, linked me in with retired military personnel who were now partisan commanders, and established a link of safe houses east to west with food, water, fuel, and things like that, which came in handy later when I was evacuating people. And then I looked after a few, just before the, I went home then, and then just before the invasion, early February, I went back, picked up a group of journalists from the mainstream media, and was with them in Donbass during the invasion. They lost my trust, as we say. We're just the three of us, myself, a correspondent, and a cameraman. And we'd moved from Kramatorsk up to Kharkiv, where the battle was going on there. And it was a lot of fighting going on. We moved in, and I went forward and spoke to the local commander and said, is it right if we film here? He said, yep, not a problem, just so long as you don't film over there. And definitely don't go live. So I looked across, and you could see guys looked a bit different than the rest, and it was SBU Alpha. And they were, you know, prepping to push in. The SBU basically is like, there isn't really a, we don't have an equivalent in the West, US, or, you know, they're a special forces unit, but come under the police. But of course, they got an intelligence unit and you know, cyber crime and all the rest of it. This was the active military arm of that group, and they're a cut above the rest. And you could tell by the way, not just what they were dressed and equipped with, but the way they moved, the way they spoke to each other. They're good guys, you know. Anyway, the correspondent said, "We're not going to film." And then went across the road and was speaking into a mic and said he's just doing a radio show, when in fact, the cameraman behind my back, both of them, went live. And they moved away and were remoting their voice over the camera on a live feed. 10 minutes later, the commander turned up going nuts, saying the regional general, if you like, he's on his way. You're giving the Russians a fucking live feed of what we're about to do. And I turned to him, I was like, you cunt, turn the camera off. And he said, nah, I'm live, and laughed. And I thought, I'm in the middle now. And I thought, you don't realise the situation situation you've put these guys in, and me, and us. And this commander, I sort of turned back into a soldier in my mind. Because I can imagine that, you know, and that poor commander, he'd already given us permission to film, and now he's going to get his ass chewed by the regional general, probably lose his job, lose his rank, and I just put myself in his shoes. I thought, you cunts. And the cameraman still refused to turn the camera off. And these guys are getting irate and playing with their triggers, and I thought, you're going to get shot in a minute. So I had to heighten the hype then. So I just turned my back and the shoulders, soldiers, screamed my head off at the cameraman and the correspondent, grabbed the camera, threw it in the van, still plugged in, live, and threw them in the car and all. Turned around, drove off. Drove down to Dnieper then with these two idiots screaming their heads off behind me. And I just said, you idiots, you know. And just after that, a missile came in. And I know it killed a few people because of them. So they're then screaming at me in the vehicle on the way to Dnieper saying, oh, are we going to do this? We're going to do that. I couldn't give a shit. I said, I'm not working with you again. Dropped them off in Dnieper and just said, fuck off. I then linked up with some other mates, and there was a lot of people that needed evacuating then. So I moved back into Donbass, picked up a mother and a young child. I was expecting to pick up an old woman and an old daughter. Instead, I picked up a 25-year-old girl with a 3-year-old baby. Oh, fuck. So we drove off then, heading west towards Romania, and the weather was horrendous. And about 25 minutes into it, the poor girl tapped me on the shoulder and said, I can't do this without my mum. I said, no worries. And this is the bit that makes me cringe, because you've probably seen at the time people throwing out $10,000 a day for this and that, you know. And Her husband was in the States, business Ukrainian businessman. That company had paid for her to be evacuated. It was a human being, you know. And she says, I can't do this without my mum. So I said, I'm not going to ring up, you know, those who are paying or those who are fucking charging and say, I'm going to go and pick her mother up. Because these creatures will go another 10 grand. So I just ignored it, drove back into Donbass, picked up Grandma, who was amazing, slung her in the back, turned around and headed back to Romania. Whereas at that time, no one really knew what was going to go on next, because there was Russian jets flying all over the place. And it was a massive traffic jam, probably 60 miles long. And that's what a lot of the politicians termed the humanitarian corridor. It wasn't. It was a fucking traffic jam. But it started to get to a point where people were panicking, screaming past the traffic, and then you go on an hour and you'd see multiple pile-ups, you know, and literally, you know, children in trees where cars have been smashed head-on collisions, you know, because people were in a panic. And the irony is, every single car in that traffic jam were rich people. There was no poor kids, poor families, larders. It was all Range Rovers, BMWs, Mercedes, you know. And a lot of the so-called refugees outside of Ukraine now are the rich people. They're not the poor. The poor didn't have a chance to escape, you know. And most of those are the ones putting out the fires now, working in hospitals, police, and on the front line. But yeah, so it started to get a bit dodgy. So I called a mate of mine who I'd asked to come back from Baghdad. And he said, you know, if I cross the border back, I can't leave because he's a Ukrainian. You know, I said, all right, no worries. I got him work anyway, but he's well connected with a lot of the partisans there. And I shit you not, this happened. So I said to, I won't say his name, but we're stuck in this traffic jam at this location and we ain't going anywhere quick. Russian jets flew over us. and it was a snow, the weather was horrendous. And still you had the crazy cars screaming past, head-on collisions. It was nuts, you know. The next thing, a guy, I swear to God, a guy, I've already explained where we were and what car we were in, but a guy knocked the window. So I put the window down. And he handed me a phone and pointed at it and said my Ukrainian mate's name. I'm in the middle of nowhere, right? Then I picked it up and my mate went, go with these guys. I went, all right, fuck. Put the phone down and then came out of the traffic jam, drove up and then went through a gap in the traffic jam into a forested area. And then we seen these two sort of pine trees across the road, like a makeshift sort of checkpoint. And literally it was like something out of World War II. These partisans came out of the woods and sort of said, come with us. So we drove up through the forest, up onto these hills, and this is like these shack villages, you know. And the women came out, and I met the local commander, who was a mate, used to be my mate's commander in what was then Ukrainian Spetsnaz. And the girls looked after the girls, and me and the driver I was with, a good lad, Ukrainian guy, spent the night there. And yeah, just an absolutely bizarre, surreal situation, you know, sat outside looking at the stars with this old Spetsnaz commander that had fought in Afghanistan himself. Look, you know, stargazing at northeast, southwest, and chatting about navigating and fucking drinking dodgy vodka. But then, yeah, so the next day, they shook our hands, and then we made our way to Romania then. And this was probably the 3rd of March, 2nd of March, 3rd of March after the invasion. And there was nothing at the border. It was an absolute madness fucking traffic jam there and gangs of people. And there was a few, like, I think it was the Turkish Red Crescent, a few Sikh and Jewish humanitarian groups just in a little tent. Serving soup, but there was no UN, Red Cross, nothing like that, just volunteers then. But it was, people are just out in the snow, no cover, in a queue. It must have been well below freezing. But the area that it is, it slipped. A few locals there sat in vans at the border guards, some money. And feel a bit bad about it, really, because there's a lot of others there freezing. But that got them through the border anyway, to the front. And that was my sort of start in Ukraine. Most of the media in hostile environments will have a security advisor with them. Then you just, it's not a bodyguard's job, which a lot of people think it is. You're there. I mean, you can physically grab them and pull them out, you know, but your job isn't to move away from danger, but mitigate the risk and be within that area as safe as you can without, you know, getting injured. You're also conducting the intelligence threat assessments and things like that, you know. You're with them, but you try and look like, you know, a member of the crew rather than some knuckle dragging goon, you know.
You said you were in Lebanon at one point. Do you mind like divulging a little bit what your role was there?
I was with the media again there as a media advisor. I established evacuation routes out to Cyprus and Turkey and things like that. I don't really want to delve too much into the goings on the border there, like Wagner. Yeah.
So, again, I'm not sure if this is something that's necessarily like appropriate to talk about, but between kind of regular military, and I guess what people in your line of work would call the circuit, I understand a lot of the motivation is that the pay in like the private sector is better. Is that true? Because I've heard conflicting things. Some people say it's better. Some people say it's about the same.
So, yeah, basically the circuit's always been around. Prior to Iraq, everything was, it didn't include resumes and CVs. Everything was on recommendation. And the rule was, if you recommend someone and they fuck up, you're both gone. And that's how it was. Then you Iraq kicked off, and suddenly it was the $1 billion business, and everyone wanted to get their fingers in it, you know. Standards dropped, and you got a lot of shit in there to fill seats, which made a lot of people a lot of money. But, you know, due diligence sort of went by the wayside with a lot of people and a lot of companies. Then we probably had 20 years of that, where everything was blurred. You know, you could be stood next to some minister's office in Baghdad, and you'll look at the counterpart and you'll start chatting, and the limit of his experience, excuse me, was a bouncer that done a fucking one of those cool gun courses somewhere in wherever. And yeah, a lot of it is like that. Around 2009, when things started rolling down, and then when Afghanistan closed down, it suddenly went to a sort of tier system, and it's now gone back to how it used to be, where, yeah, you've got a lot of jobs going. Like, it's a lot of jobs in Iraq now, but, you know, you could earn more as a postman than a team leader in Iraq, sat on an oil rig all day. And these are the types that come back and go, yeah, I'm a bodyguard, I'm this, I'm that. And you're a fucking taxi driver, dude, you know. And the decent sort of high-paying jobs have gone back to the on-recommendation thing. You know, people, I think it's an absolute scam now. People, you know, selling these bodyguard courses to service leavers. They ain't going to get a job. And if they do get a job, it'll be shit pay. Unless they're a, you know, senior NCO officer from the special operations background. But the chances of a service leaver now getting on a very well-paid job with no experience on the circuit, and it doesn't matter if they were a sniper in this, that, and the other. Nobody cares. You need some sort of background and a link so people can find out who you are and do a background check on you. You know, a veiled one through that circuit, you know. Absolutely no chance of people slipping through the net these days on small, high-paying jobs. Not a chance.
Were you in Iraq, like, in like for the armed services?
Yeah.
What was your job in what years?
I went in on the invasion. The helicopter crashed. I went in with the CH-46 C-9 with what was then called Brigade Reconnaissance Force. And I think it was the first coalition casualties of the war. The helicopter crashed and killed all the senior command. Yeah. So we then had to come back to Kuwait, get on another aircraft, go in, and then shoot up. And we did. Yeah. That was a load of bullshit, that war. Basically looking for targets, prioritizing them, categorizing them, and then either continue to observe them or destroy them. That was my job, really.
So just one quick question, then we're gonna just move on from Iraq. But I wanted to know, because it's rare that I actually find people that are in the invasion, just because it was so long ago. Did you feel an energy shift after the end of 2003? You know, when Bush comes out and says mission accomplished, you know, and early 2004 to November, you all, you know, that year, did you feel an energy shift, or was it just always in it and always felt the same to you?
All right. So I was over the border, probably some of the first troop, and we made our way north from there. We never met anyone who wanted to fight. Met a few Iraqis running off in their underwear, you know, yeah, I'll give you an example, right? We did, my team did the close target reconnaissance of Basra Palace with the NSW, you know, the special boat guys from the States, plotted targets in the palace, had a C-130 Spectre gunship on call, and we could have hit every single one of them, but we got an abort, and you can't ask why. So we went back to a place called LS Neptune and waited, and then 12 hours later we're told to come to the palace, and we went in, and half the three commander brigades in there, and they see us coming in, and they're going, well, you should have been here first. I thought we were here last night in the fucking river. And they're like, what? I said, how did you come in? They went, oh, well, we had CNN, Sky News, ABC. I thought, yeah, of course. They wanted the band playing.
That's why they called it off, is because they needed the press for it, right? Is that what you're implying? Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, it was the same. I mean, fuck. Back to the night of the invasion, you know, we were the guys to go in to form a reconnaissance screen so the guys could come in from the south, and we would either hit or pre-warn of armor moving south, which is laughable, actually, because the CIA had already bought off the fucking armored commanders anyway, hadn't they? But we got off the helicopter and were spun a story in Kuwait that the helicopter that crashed had gone into Kuwait, was hit by Iraqi ZSU-23-4s, heroically made its way back and crashed in the desert in Kuwait. Like, bullshit. Because that helicopter was right next to us. And we hadn't even crossed the water in the Shatt al-Arab River into Iraq. So, fuck off. Utter lies. You know, we'd only been in the air 15 minutes and we're back on the ground. And we spun this bullshit story. So, even before I went into Iraq, I was like, here we fucking go.
So the energy changing in 2004.
Yeah, absolutely. But we should have, as has been said a million times, we should have kept hold of the military and retrained it or something like that. But we just hung around like a bad smell, purposely, I think, to, you know, bring forth an insurgency that, of course, did come and continued. And even throughout 2004, you know, people go, what are we doing here? What do they have anything to do with 9/11 and all the rest of it, you know?
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is how did England convince people to be like, yeah, let's go to Iraq? Because obviously it's America's war, really.
Which is why, you know, unlike the Falklands War, not when we came back in civilians in a civilian aircraft at 2 o'clock in the morning, not daytime, with uniforms on, waving flags. You know, we were not as bad as, but when we got back, it was quite low profile, and we were still viewed as sort of like when the Americans come back home from Vietnam. I kind of got it, but those are the kind of things that later on, you know, push guys to suicide. A war with no goal, you know, what's the fucking target? We made the target. The target wasn't an insurgency, but we fought that insurgency for years. It didn't exist when we went in, you know, because we hung around, and I think we hung around for a long time. I mean, years later, I was working with a geologist, an Italian geologist, on the southern border in a place called Safwan, on the Kuwaiti border. And you got the UN demarcation line there. And this old guy, he's late 60s, you know, and he's been a geologist for an oil company for decades. He said, oil rig over there? I went, yeah. He goes, I used to work on that years ago. And that was in Iraq then. Because, of course, they invented the angular drill, didn't they? And they still use it now. That drilled under the Kuwait into Iraq and was nicking Iraq soil. That's why Saddam Hussein went into Kuwait. Kuwait was stealing the oil.
That's very interesting.
You spoke a little bit earlier about how a lot of these jobs kind of in the private sector, if I was understanding you correctly, they don't really make sense. A lot of them are kind of like glorified positions. Mm-hmm. However, a place where we do see a lot of governments, I guess you'd say, turning to sort of the private military sector to take care of their issues is Africa, right? So you see, obviously, Wagner's there. You see a lot of South African private military companies operating there. Just kind of in your experience, do you think that's like a good strategy? That's something that could clean up a lot of the insurgencies over there? Do you think it's like, it's kind of like a tentative thing? What are your thoughts on that?
Depends on the size, I think. Wagner is divisional level size, you know? And again, you've got rules and regulations, you know, and again, a large spectrum of standards. If it's done well, and I'll use executive outcomes as a good example.
They're the South African company, correct?
Yeah, and it still exists now. But they did a lot what others couldn't achieve at half the price, you know. The problem is it kind of almost embarrasses and undermines militaries and politicians don't like that, you know. The way it can be done is where you put, similar to how US Special Forces work, I guess, is put a handful of guys in amongst those groups, you know, and lead them, advise, assist, and lead. Then you can achieve a lot more with a much smaller footprint, you know.
Because it seems as though, like, a good, like, particular example of where it kind of made sense was, I guess, Mozambique, because a lot of the areas in Palma in 2021 that were kind of under attack were gas, they were searching for oil and gas there. There was like, they were going to build these projects, and then obviously the Islamic State comes in and kind of fucks that up for them.
Yeah.
And so I guess it makes sense, right? You have all these private companies come in because it is, they're kind of coming on behalf of Total Energies, right? They're not really coming on behalf of the government necessarily.
Yeah.
But I look at places like, you know, Mali, the Central African Republic, especially, where it's like, it seems like they've almost taken over the conventional military. And it's like, they're kind of the ones like almost running the show, it seems. And obviously, you know, Wagner has its ulterior motives. There's that report that came out that, like, you know, there's $2 billion worth of gold that they took from Mali or the CAR or wherever. But it's just, I think it's an interesting phenomenon where it's like you have these private military contractors coming from outside that are basically like almost making the military obsolete in a way. It's kind of weird.
When you speak to people who've been to Mali, I mean, it's no exaggeration at times. You can kick the sand and see gold. I mean, I won't say who, but there's one Western country that was kicked out because they were mining for gold on their camp. There's a lot of gold there, and it goes back a long, 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 long time. I mean, the old king of Mali was once the richest man on earth, wasn't he? So it's still a country teeming in gold. And that's one of the reasons why everyone wants to get in there. It was interesting. Burkina Faso closed down Nordgold, I think it's called, which is a Russian company. They kicked them out, which is interesting because I always assumed they were on side with the Russians, but they've been kicked out there now, which is just to the south of Mali. They cleaned up. But gold is always a thing in Africa, along with diamonds. You know, the Chinese run Zimbabwe now with industrial diamonds. and everyone's at it. You know, it's not that many non-corrupt countries there. Botswana, not bad. Zambia, very good.
Ghana's okay.
Ghana's good. They got actually one of the best jungle warfare schools I've ever been to there. And they're pretty switched on guys too. Not a bad place.
China, they found oil there, right? And China came in to like build their oil, and then they took all the jobs and didn't give them to the people there. And like suddenly Ghana's in an economic crisis. I'm sure it has nothing to do with the Chinese being there, though.
The Chinese have a thing wherever they go, like 99% of the people they employ are only Chinese. Did it in Iraq. We see CNPC, the oil company. And the rule in Iraq is, I think, if you want to do business in Iraq, 80% of your workforce must be Iraqis, which is fair enough. The Chinese still don't do that.
Well, I think it's a Belt and Road Initiative thing. It's like a part of that deal that if they sign it, that they can import Chinese workers. So realistically, this whole injection of labor and
people they're going to get jobs from this too.
Yeah.
Like the government always tell, like Ghana, all these people who helped build the facility for the oil. Everyone I've talked to, all of them said that they were promised jobs basically by the local government. And then it gets built, and then there's never been any jobs. It was a lie the entire time just to like have them build it instead of like because they needed the labor to exploit the oil.
It's the same in, look, anyway, Gambia, the fishermen were like, yeah, because the Chinese come in, they were building a new port, but the port was for their industrial trawler that they came in, took a year's worth of fish in one go, and left. And they processed it in that port and left. And the fishermen are like, where's all the fucking fish gone? Somalia the same.
Lately, there's been talks. We've talked a lot about ECOWAS. Now, all these countries that had these coups, they're talking about basically forming a new country out of all of them, you know, because of security cooperation and all these things. What do you think of that, like, narrative that, like, there's always been this ulterior motive for Russia to go in and coup those countries that were coup, Burkina Faso, like, you know, there's like three of them that are going to be forming some security cooperation.
No, you're on about Mali. When
Mali was 2021, Burkina Faso was 2022, and then they did it again in the same year because I guess Traoré, who's in power now, decided he didn't like the guy who was running things. And then Niger did it earlier this year. And the idea behind it is, and I'm sure you understand this better than I do because you have the military background, but the idea behind it is because the way a lot of the groups, right, you got the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara, JNIM, which is linked to Al-Qaeda, the way they operate in like sectors, but they're also very mobile because there's obviously these countries, they're very big and there's like these long stretches of unpatrolled border, right? So you'll have like a commander within a group like, say, JNIM, he'll be part of an attack in Mali and he'll be in Niger like a day later and then he'll wind up dead in a drone strike in Burkina Faso, right? They're moving, like the borders don't really matter to them is what I'm saying. These groups have kind of made the borders obsolete. So the idea with these three countries forming this alliance is that they'd be able to better tackle the security crisis there.
You're not wrong. Mali was an empire in itself anyway, long ago, but it is effectively, I won't say one group of people, but a number of tribes that have always cooperated with each other since they, for 1,000 years. Trade and industry isn't going that well for them in the modern world. It used to. They've got a lot of links with each other anyway. It's an easy link to sort of exploit for countries like Russia. You know, they don't make, not like Venezuela, you know, all the oil in the world and everyone's poor. There's more gold there than most places on earth and everyone's still poor. Someone's making a fast buck, you know. And you look to who's arming these factions, and, you know, it's Russia. A lot of it is to keep the border areas unstable.
Like if this were to happen, I think maybe from a economic perspective, it wouldn't, I don't know if it would make a whole lot of sense. I mean, the economy isn't really working very well in the three of these countries, but I think from a security perspective, it would make sense because ultimately three Sahelian nations, they're kind of dealing with the same security problems. They're fighting the same guys, right? I just think it would make sense. It's like, yeah, if Burkina wants to operate drone strikes in Mali, where Mali may not have the capacity, then sure.
When I first heard this federation thing, I was like, bullshit. I'm so used to like dictators not wanting to share power. But I didn't know what you said is they have historically worked together in the past before they were like divided into these states. And I think that's really interesting.
Two questions here. Obviously, South Africa is very heavily involved in sort of the private military industry because of after apartheid, they dissolved the army and a lot of these guys went on to found these different private military contractors. Have you had any experiences with them?
Even during the apartheid era, the South African military still had blacks in it. And amongst the special forces units, they were treated as equal. They were teams, you know. It was outside in the civilian world where all the shit was going on. Well, I work with quite a lot of South African recce, the special forces guys. Very, very, very good. The problem is that the units still go on today, but they're not even a shadow of what they used to be. And the guys from these units were all late 50s, 60s, and older now. And it was a funny thing in Iraq, because every South African you met, he was a recce. But when you spoke to recces you knew, they'd suddenly go all timid and say, oh, no, they ain't. They were living off, unforgivably, their forefathers' past reputations, you know. Very small group of people. Some of them are still going strong, but like I say, most of them are late 50s, early 60s, and they're the younger ones, you know. Same, you know, with Zimbabwe, Rhodesia.
Right. And then another question I had for you is, like, you know, obviously being just in the military in general, you kind of end up going to a lot of interesting places. What has been, I guess, your most interesting deployment or job, and to which country, if you're allowed to say?
I would have joked and said Driftwood in Camp Lejeune. No, it's a bar that used to be there with the Marines, but that was just for fun. Probably Norway. Or the jungle, in that pure soldiering, you have to make friends with the environment you operate in first, before you even begin to think about fighting an enemy. And both of those environments, Arctic, mountainous, and jungle, very, very good environments to be in to hone your personal skills and then your team skills as well. And if you can do that, you're pretty much formidable. And what I think is really important is to stay in the field for a longer period of time like we used to. I mean, the Brits still do it a lot now. We've got too many niceties around us, and, you know, guys can come back to camps and it's got internet and shit like that. To really operate well, you've got to be away from all that and become one with sort of nature. And I've seen it, you know, the jungle, for example. I've worked in all the jungles around the, you know, Central Africa, Far East, and Central America. You've got to make friends with it. And you, almost in a superstitious way, you'll get guys who are fucking around with insects and scorpions and flicking centipedes. They're always the ones that get bit or fucked.
Yeah, that's the thing that gets me about the jungle, is like the shit that might be out there, you know what I mean? Like, as far as poisonous animals and shit like that. That's
Yeah. I've had a few funny things, you know, laying in a hammock at night in Kenya, in the Kasindini forest, and I look across, because they always say, you know, don't eat anything before you go to sleep, as in, you know, wash your mouth and everything, because the rats will have you there. And I look across, and there's this fucking huge rat on my mate's chest while he's sleeping, and he just crawls up and bites him on the face. It's a funny thing as well, you know, I mean, whenever you go to a different country, sort of dive headfirst into their culture too, you know. We were in a place in Kenya once, and I could hear a load of screaming in the morning where the guy's gone for a wash, you know, after breakfast, before breakfast. And guys look like they've all been burned, and they've got, like, scars all over their faces, and they don't know what the fuck it is. It's called a Nairobi fly, and it lands on you and sprays formic acid on you. The same thing that's in ants, you know. And it burns the skin, right? And the doc's going, fuck, what the hell's this? And no one knows how to get rid of it. And these guys look like they got fucking second degree burns. Speak to the locals, they just laugh. They just put milk on it. Put milk on it and it goes immediately. You know, but I've had experiences like that all over the world, you know, places. Same in Ghana in the jungle there, fucking fire ants. Same thing, formic acid, just put an alkaloid on it, gone. The guys run around screaming, ripping their clothes off in the jungle. When the guys were in Sierra Leone, you know, a few died of cerebral malaria. And then you got all the other nasty beasties. You just, it's personal administration while you're in that environment. You know, small things can fuck you. Like, sounds silly, cutting your toenails. People go, what? You know, you don't cut your toenails, you'll get a little scratch on your toe from your other toenail. In a festering jungle where you're soaking wet every day and the temperature's 100 degrees, you're fucked, because that's going to get septic and then all other host of beasties will happen. If you can't walk, you can't fight. These little things about, you know, looking after yourself. And a lot of it, I don't know what it's like in your countries, but within our military law, certain things like that are considered, you know, self-inflicted injuries, and you can get charged for it. Not looking after yourself, just basic administration, you know. The smallest of things can screw you over. If you let it, you know, don't tape your feet up. You got a blister, ah, fuck it. I'll go through it. Then it goes septic. Then your feet swell. You can't walk, so your team is down a guy. Could be the medic. You could be the medic in the team. Especially if you're in a unit that's, you know, prone to capture behind enemy lines for a long period of time. Can't bring a helicopter in to come and get you out. It's a mission to do. And you've just fucked it up by not cutting your toenails. You know, things can go drastically bad quickly if you don't, you know, sort yourself out first.
It goes back to what you said before, that there's too many niceties. People are too comfortable, I guess. And this isn't even like a military thing either. This is just a general thing. It's like people are too... Like let's say the... Cause I was talking about this the other day because a solar flare hit the Earth and disrupted radio waves. And they're like, there might be a mass coronal ejection, which would disrupt a lot of shit. And I'm like, if the electricity went out for a week because of some kind of solar flare or something like that, some kind of freak accident we can't predict, people are fucked. Fucked.
I was talking about this to a friend yesterday, actually. The Russians are doing the same now as they did last winter in Ukraine.
Mm.
Hitting, you know, the electricity systems, the communication systems and things. Last winter, I was in Kiev. We just come back from Donbass. And they'd hit the electricity systems. So Kiev was black. All the lights are out and the cell phones are off. And people go straight into a panic. And if you sit and think, I mean, I remember, well, I'm not that old. I remember when we used to queue up to use the payphone, or just, you know, wait till you see them, knock on someone's door if you want to speak to them. But it's bizarre now, having lived without cell phones, and now in a world where people can't live without them. You take a cell phone away from someone now, they have almost a panic attack. Or have an entire city without a cell phone, and there was car crashes and everything, people screaming out of the city, you know, trying to get cell phone coverage in another city just to feel connected. It's bizarre, but it's a weapon as well, you know. Mm-hmm. Double-edged sword.
I just wanted to kind of steer the conversation back over. Do you find I hear this a lot, but do you find that, like, a lot of the jobs in private military contracting, and I've also heard that these are, I guess, the more lucrative jobs, is training other militaries. So they'll bring in guys from a certain contractor or whatever to train an army out in, I don't know, let's pick a country, like
Jordan,
Ethiopia, for example, Jordan or something like that.
Yes, but more no, in that we've already got units that do that. And for example, you've got a US-based company that trains an army that would go against your country's foreign policy, your company won't last long, you know. Today, the majority of the training, I mean, we've got training going on in, you know, we train the UAE and Saudi Arabia, you know, British contracts, with British contractors doing that. But it's still in line with UK foreign policy. Now, if they went to go and train Wagner, that would be a different thing altogether, you know. But then you've got to watch out for contractors too, in that it just by fluke this tied up. Remember when Wagner got hit hard in Syria? That was during the period where you suddenly got thousands of contractors that are out of work from Afghanistan and Iraq, because both of those countries are rolling down on the security side as well. So through a recruiter in Geneva, Wagner started recruiting for Westerners, and did straight after that hit in Syria. And a lot of guys will just look at the money and not think of future threats. But I'm sure Russia was thinking, you'll not hit us again unless you want to be seen to be hitting your own people this time, you know. Well, yeah, a lot of Westerners joined Wagner then around that period.
Start, like, the media didn't really start becoming aware of what Wagner was until they started getting involved in Africa around 2019, 2020.
Yeah.
And then it propelled further with Ukraine and the whole Prigozhin going off and all that.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I guess the next question would be is, obviously, when it comes to this type of work, that you have people who might be trying, you know, governments might be trying to get services and private companies might be trying to get services. Obviously, you know, people have, these private companies have things that are very valuable and they want to protect them. Which do you find is more common? Governments trying to procure services from PMCs or private companies? Because for a while, it seemed as though it was mostly private companies that were trying to get these types of services. But again, with Wagner and Blackwater kind of coming in into the fray, it seems as though it changed. Governments were trying to procure these types of services.
They do, in a sense. One of the big things, and I'll use Ukraine, is a lot of companies want to get in there, start stuff, but can't because they can't get insurance because it's an active war zone. Whereas people like myself and others can freely move around the country. We have contacts there, and we know where to go, where not to go, and you know what the ground is like, the people is like. And so you can get those jobs done for them. I can see a push there soon because of, fuck, I mean, most of the, you know, Ukraine's got, I think, I forget the percentage, something like either 2% or 7% of the most fertile land on Earth, you know. And when people talk about Ukrainian grain and this, that, and the other, all the land was sold off. Hardly any of the agricultural land in Ukraine is owned by Ukraine. It's sold off to private investors. Which is why you got the likes of BlackRock and all the rest of them that want to get in. That will then have effects on government, especially the US, where it is undeniably led by big business. They'll try and push for a peace agreement. I guarantee it, or I guarantee they won't accept it, and it's going to smack them right in the face.
Yeah, I think that's, we already have seen some of that. Obviously, it's going to get a lot more intense, but just because, like, I think with our conservatives, they're a little bit more open about, like, just taking these big corporate donations, and the corporate backers tend to lean towards more them. And, like, from the start, them just being opposed to giving Ukraine any money, it wasn't about taking care of our own people, as they say, you know. It's about, hey, these companies that fund us want contracts there, and they can't do it if they don't have insurance.
I mean, even in the early days of the war, I'm sorry, not the early days of the war, the days, like the months and days leading up to the war, Zelensky was saying, oh, no, there's not going to be a war. There's not going to be a war. And that was like, people were saying, like, it's not that Zelensky doesn't see it coming, but it's that he doesn't want to scare away the, yeah, he didn't want to scare away any investors.
Yeah.
So, like, it's just very interesting that these people are trying to act holier than thou when realistically their opinion comes at the behest of their corporate backers. It's just like it's that or you're a shill for Russia and their invasion of a sovereign nation. Like it's one or the other. I am yet to hear an argument for Russia's invasion that is not ridiculously revolting.
Yeah, not even one that's like moderate, you know. It's all,
yeah, there isn't a moderate support for
it's not Russia. It's like a Assadist. There's no moderate Assadist.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? They're all vile. So I think for a wrap up question, I mean, unless somebody has anything else to say, because on the notion of capitalism, there's a huge kind of notion that capitalism causes wars and all these things, that the capitalists want these countries unstable. But then on the other side of it, they need these countries to be stable to get insurance. You know, what do you think there? What do you think is more of the case?
You know, I'll use Ghana as an example. And I spoke to a agency type guy there who was drunk. And he guys were saying, there's so many precious minerals here, and yet you see people sat on the streets. And he says it pays to keep a country in poverty. It's, you know, years later I pondered over that. And it's within reason true. If you can keep a country dumbed down, you can take what you want. In Venezuela's got the largest oil reserves in the world. It's a shithole. And it's a shithole for a reason. And it's not because of anything else other than bad leadership and poor education and terrible government, you know. But in terms of pointing the finger at conservatism, I don't. If it's done well, it's done well. But it's how you project it, you know. I'm not really. I think we're gone. I think it's almost naive to think we're still in a world of conservative governments. Left and right are pretty much exactly the same now. One lies to your face, or rather, one will pretend they care but don't, and the other ones will tell you to their face they couldn't give a fuck.
We both kind of are at a point where we think that this binary system needs to go.
It's not even
whether that's left or right, communism, capitalism, whatever that might be, just this binary thinking of one or the other is just a dangerous 20th century mindset that needs to be left there.
It's just like the nature of states. You know, there's just certain things that you just know states are going to do and you can expect them to do.
Mm-hmm. But the problem with that, I mean, the larger the population of a country, the more draconian it'll get, or it'll collapse, which is why you see these large countries have dictators in charge. Because I also think that, especially in the modern world, people aren't responsible anymore. It'll collapse if you don't have some form of guidance. I'll not say leadership, but guidance. And without that, it won't be a country. It'll be gone. If you do have a country that is responsible, I would say the best system of governance would be what we don't have now. You know, if you someone who's in charge of finance should be a mathematician. Someone who's in charge of agriculture should be a biologist or a fucking old farmer. Someone who's in charge of education should be a professor. We don't see this anymore. Everything's corrupt. Someone will give a bit of money. But if everyone in governance of a country had the education and skill within that field, then you've got a perfect country, along with freedom and everything else. But I don't believe in sort of lawlessness, bro. There's a fine line between lawful and draconian, you know?
But that brings another question, is like, what is lawless, right? Because realistically...
Okay, look at Northern Syria. They certainly have order there in a certain respect, you know?
Because it's this deeper question, which we're obviously not going to have time for. But it's like the question of what are laws. I ask people this all the time. I'm like, what are laws? Laws are guides, written by humans, written by people elected by other people. But if you live in a country like Australia where you don't actually elect your leaders, who are making those rules? Who are making those laws? And what justification do they have to enact those laws? Who enact those laws? You know, all these questions come into it, and it's like, you know, what is the difference between a system of laws and lawlessness if not for the authority itself enforcing it, right? So it comes down to the authority, I think. Who is the authority in charge? Who?
That doesn't work either, because as in, like the UK has the same system as Australia, doesn't it?
I think the reason
why the US has the system it has is to counter exactly that. But again, it's you got one house ruling one side and the Senate, and so it can still be bent, I think, even the best system in the world. And again, I think it just comes down to national responsibility. That doesn't exist. Yeah. In the West today,
I think media is a
big part of that as well. Just how there's certain Germany is pretty good about this in comparison, but like I just feel like especially with Australian, UK, and American journalism that we've seen and stuff and reporting, especially like even around the war in Ukraine, it's almost like they don't want people to be informed about stuff. What was interesting is in the beginning of Ukraine, like they started like actually with Bucha, especially they started actually showing people how to do like open source investigations and like how to find stuff and fact check.
Mm.
But it was only after Bucha. And then now it's just like back to the usual shit. Like with Israel, man, it's just insane.
If it matters at all, but my grandfather, he was in the Egyptian military. And at the time, you know, the war was happening between them and Israel, and obviously Syria was involved. And when they were preparing, they were doing like military exercises and stuff. They had them, you know, wearing gas masks, things of that nature. And they were like, oh, what are these like gas masks for? Like, do the Israelis have chemical weapons? And an officer had told them, they were like, no, this is in case Syria drops something, because apparently Assad had been not Assad, his dad.
Assad's father was absolutely despised, and he's in Lebanon today.
Yeah,
despised.
Yeah, because at the time when Assad had taken power in like the early 70s or the late 60s, I can't remember when exactly, but he'd started developing a chemical weapons program, and it was Hafez al-Assad, right? And it was like the idea was if things went really bad during a war with Israel, they drop chemical weapons. And they also say that like this is part of, I mean, there was a thing too where
I mean the things that did go really bad for them.
they didn't do it. Yeah, that's what they were worried about. But there were also things like that came out later that British intelligence had been helping Saddam Hussein in the 80s build chemical weapons, and they'd helped him build a production facility for that. But yeah, I mean,
it was a lot more than that.
Yeah, yeah. We're working on a story about it.
Transport it too. Yeah, we have a lot of talks about this, but yeah, that's the thing. That those are the things that always get me, man. It's like these types of secretive weapons programs and stuff. And people are always worried about like nuclear bombs and whatnot. I think a dirty bomb, like a chemical bomb, is far worse.
Oh yeah,
because I think it's more likely. Yeah. You know what I mean?
It's like I said, it's really easy to make a chlorine device.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean,
like, all you need is a wastewater treatment facility, and you have a chlorine bomb manufacturing facility.
There was actually an Egyptian Al-Qaeda member who was like a chemical engineer who they were getting to do that. There was like a real concern that they would do that in the 80s. He was assassinated in like 2021, I want to say, but yeah. Just shifting over, I actually did have one last question for you, and I guess this is just kind of like with the military background and stuff. What do you find are the differences, I guess, between fighting in a conventional war, just being in a conventional type of war zone environment, versus something where you're dealing with an insurgency? What are like the main differences? Like, what would you want people to know about like these things that I guess are different between the two?
Well, I think, and again, Ukraine has hit us hard in that we would find it extremely hard now, even as a combined force, to to fight against Russia because it on that environment, it's almost flat, open terrain. It's not a place for special forces. It's not a place for, you know, airborne troops and things like that. It's a place for armor and artillery. And the actual artillery storage that the Russians had absolutely blew us away. You know, I was in Bakhmut earlier this year. And when you go over the hill and you look down into the valley where Bakhmut is, and you're like, holy shit, there's an artillery round landing every second of every day, day and night, all year. And it's a noise you'll never hear in your life. Straight out of World War One, and you're looking at it, and we were going into it, but it's like, you know, your body's screaming like, do not go there. No, we don't have that, those kind of supplies to counter that. So you can be the best soldier in the world, meaningless, unless you can fight against something with that kind of joint fires capability. We don't. We've gone so technical. And against those Russia at the same time, you know, their EW is knocking off HIMARS, and HIMARS is missing. Now switch that to insurgency. We failed twice at that, didn't we? there's ways of conducting those fights. I don't think we did it correctly. Like Afghanistan is another classic. Afghanistan was a special forces war, but we made it bigger. We could have finished it by using special operations troops from an intelligence, from the coalition. Instead, we went there en masse, fucked it. Iraq, that could have been done as a special forces war after the war proper had finished in, you know, early 2000.
I mean, like it is now, you know, like it's like basically no active people are there. They're just like there to advise, you know, could have easily done that.
We didn't have to be there in en masse, but, you know, to get into a conspiracy theory, but I'm sure a lot of people made a lot of money at that in the defense industry, but too many people died for no reason on all sides in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we could have done that far better with a millionth of the amount of feet on the ground and done well, I think. And we'd probably be getting, you know, all the mining jobs now and all, you know, but the Chinese just walked in and grabbed them without firing a shot.
Yeah, I don't think Afghanistan is going to be very happy about that in about 5 years, but we'll see. Whether they can actually do anything or not is the other question.
But it's an untapped resource, that's for sure.
I mean, just to add some perspective to this, China has done a similar thing in Pakistan, in like this area of Pakistan, this province of Pakistan called Balochistan. And it's like, it's a disputed area, right? These people don't really, the people there, some of them, a lot of them don't really feel like they're part of Pakistan. And oftentimes, like, there's a lot of Chinese workers there, and oftentimes they're the targets. And it doesn't really seem like they have a lot of protection there outside of, like, local police and things like that, and the Pakistani military. So I wonder, like, if China were to really go in hard with the resource projects and the development in Afghanistan, you know, is it going to kind of be like that situation where they're just sitting ducks for whoever wants to,
you know, attack them? I think that would happen, yeah.
I mean, and the other thing too is like, and a lot of people have written about this recently, a lot of kind of like, you know, the ISK and the ISIS Central Asia province, a lot of their propaganda there, especially because there's like this kind of like ideological rift where the Taliban are cooperating a bit more with China diplomatically. A lot of the propaganda is like targeting like China now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously they've got, there's a lot of, you know, Uyghurs who are in those groups, and a lot of the propaganda these days is targeting China.
Yeah, I mean, you go there. I mean, it's each village may as well be its own world. Hardly anyone does any sort of traveling outside those areas. And even if the Taliban sign these forms and get the Chinese in, you know, and allow them to mine,
I mean, what are the villagers going to think, you know?
Like, exactly. Yeah. You know. So then the Chinese will have to do a similar thing that we did, where you'd have to go in, meet the locals, and, you know, bribe them.
Hearts and minds, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of these people can't be bought.
Well, I was gonna say it's gonna be very interesting because China has been doing a lot of anti-Islam stuff, like taking down minarets off non-Uyghur people.
My Islamist friends were just bitching today China because there's like now like
crazy.
MBS is over there shaking hands with China for a new deal, right?
I think at that level, they don't. I mean, you got Israel helping Azerbaijan instead of helping.
Yeah, yeah. Nobody talks about, like, I say this all the time, but the thing that we saw, the siege in Armenia that we just saw, is exactly pretty much what happened in Gaza, right? Like, these are clearly like tactics that are being shared, you know, and like. If like they don't stand up to what's happening in Gaza now, they're just giving the green light for Armenia and northern Syria. You know, it's going to be Turkey, Israel, Azerbaijan. And like Turkey pretends that they hate Israel while they're all training with each other and doing all these operations together.
Yeah, that's what I mean. What they show and what they do are very often two completely different things. You know, they got to keep that divide going, but behind the scenes, they're doing good business, you know, Saudi, Israel.
It's one of those things, particularly like the Israel-Azerbaijan relationship, where it's almost like cartoonishly, like, you know, like it's almost like a villain plot, right? Like where it's like Armenia, like, you know, Azerbaijan gets these weapons in exchange. Israel, like, gets to use Azerbaijani airspace if they want to, like, you know, bomb Iranian targets or whatever. And it's almost like, of course they're working together, right? Like, this deal is too good to be true for both parties, right? Like,
it's just Cold War shit.
Georgia will go as well soon, I think, as well.
With what? With South Ossetia and Abkhazia and that, or something different?
I think the Russians could push in now. They've probably got all the leadership there already turned and do the same there. Even if they do the same and move back, it's going to cause our focus. We spend a lot of money following all this stuff. And it drains our economies, you know.
There should be more than enough.
More than enough.
Really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Through the years, America has stood as the world symbol for law and order. Anarchy, well, that was something that was always happening in other countries. Newsworthy, perhaps, but it could never happen here. The policeman on the corner has traditionally been looked upon as a friend, not as the instrument of a tyrant. People in other countries had just reasons to riot against their governments. The nations of the world are dictatorships in one form or another.